This is an interview with Dawn Curry for the Youngstown State University Oral History Program by Darlene Weibel at the Ohio Bureau of Employment Services on South Avenue in Youngstown, Ohio, on Tuesday, December 10th, 1991, at 5 o'clock p.m. Dawn, I'd like to start out where you were born and raised.
Okay, I'm a Youngstown native, born and raised in Youngstown. Moved around several years since my father was with the Courier Department, so I spent about 5 years moving city to city just about for a year each, and then we moved back to the Youngstown Warren area in 55.
And you've been here ever since?
I've been here ever since, with time out for college in the Army.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about your growing up here.
Typical all-American, middle-class family,
What side of town did you live
in? Out in Austin Town. Mm-hmm. Family's been there, God, it is 36 years this month.
But you lived in this area all your life.
Right. Yeah, when I was born, we were out in what is now Boardman, and then wound up a few years after that going up to the Boston area, then the Cleveland area, then Warren, and then Youngstown.
But you were basically a baby then, rather than a child.
Right. I spent kindergarten, first grade, second grade, and third grade all in different schools.
Now, as you were growing up and your family was together, did you take summer vacations very much?
Yes.
Did you? Where did you go?
Lots of. The biggest one I remember is, when I graduated from eighth grade, went to Washington, D.C. for a week. But a lot of times, usually weekend types or short week, depending on when my father could get off work and all. Mm-hmm. So that was the hard part, getting time off from work.
Well, you're the first vagabond I met in all my studies so far. I was the only one out of all the interviews that took summer vacations with their family. What high school did you attend?
Austin Town Fitch,
did
class
you?
Of 1965.
Mm-hmm. And then you went on to college after that.
Right.
And what was high school and college days like?
High school was so-so, not much of a challenge. I enjoyed college probably too much. I was on the dean's list my freshman year, probation by my senior year, so.
Now, you were involved in the ROTC program.
Yeah.
At John Carroll?
At John Carroll University in Cleveland.
Now, where did you do your basic training?
Fort Benning, Georgia. Benning School for Boys.
And what year did you start that?
December of 69.
Tell me about your basic.
Well, officers basically is slightly different because they assume that we've got most of the rudiments of soldiering done beforehand, knowing how to march, how to set up. So we went into what you'd call trade training, how to lead troops, how to train troops, how to handle combat, and so on. And that was, that was 9 or 10 weeks back then. It's enlarged considerably. I think it's closer to 4 months now, but then it was, roughly 90 days. The phrase 90-day wonder still holds.
Mm-hmm. That's what that was for officers training.
Right.
And when you were finished, did you go back to school to finish up school and graduate?
No, that was after I graduated. I graduated
after?
In 1969.
Mm-hmm. And then you
went to active duty.
I see.
I got a draft notice a week after I got my orders for active duty, so
really?
That's type of thing that
you
happens.
Were already there.
Right.
So when you finished your training, your officer's training at Fort Benning, where did you go from there?
Originally, I was supposed to go to the 82nd Airborne, but I went over a cliff in Ranger training and tore my back up. So after I got off medical leave, I was reassigned to Fort Benning. That's what they call cadre. I was executive officer of a 500-man training company. All NCOs, they're the people who train soldiers. I spent about a year and a half there, running company, training, and learning myself.
Now, what were you, a second lieutenant?
I was a second lieutenant starting out, and I was a first lieutenant a year later.
Were you? And that's when you got your orders for Vietnam?
Then when I went to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
landed on the 4th of July, 1971.
Did you? Mm-hmm. And where were you stationed there?
I was stationed with the 1st Air Cavalry. Our headquarters area was in Benoit, which is one of the major cities. It's roughly 30, 40 miles from Saigon, which is the capital. Our operational area was basically in what they call the 3rd Corps, 3rd Military Region, Vietnam, which touched mainly around Tainan Province. I was in Vietnam from July 4th, 1971 to April 27th or 29th, 1972. This is when the war was supposedly winding down, but unfortunately, there's still a lot of active combat going on. I was with the 1st Air Cavalry, the 2nd Battalion, 8th Cavalry. We spent most of our time in Tainan Province, and then at the end of 1971, we moved to the Bearcat area as part of the security for Saigon and the headquarters there. My assignments are unusual. I was not the typical officer. I was an infantry officer, but I was a staff officer. I was the battalion S5, which is civil affairs officer, because I spoke Vietnamese and French, and I'd gone through training to be advisor and all. I spent most of my time doing liaison with other units of the brigade, other foreign units, Australians, Koreans, Thais, and working with the Vietnamese. I spent more time working with Vietnamese troops than I did working with American troops.
What did you do with them?
I was involved in helping train them, you know, what they called the rough pups, the regional and popular forces. The closest equivalent would be like the National Guard type. They were the people who were trained to defend basically their home areas and villages. So they're only slightly military, to say the least. Basically, it was peasants and farmers who were given self-defense training so they could protect themselves.
From
the enemy, some cases the Viet Cong, some kind of the North Vietnamese Army.
Mm-hmm.
And then I, you know, did liaison operations. I was also the assistant S2, which is intelligence, so I worked with Vietnamese in coordinating operations and psychological warfare, interrogations, things like that.
Did you interrogate prisoners?
Occasionally.
Did you?
Generally just scared the hell out of them just by showing up, since I was probably about 100 pounds larger than the average Vietnamese.
Right.
And all the stories they heard about Americans, they thought we would eat them.
Really?
So.
That was one of the stories? What other
strange
stories?
Do things like, one time dropping psychological warfare leaflets, we found most of them were used as toilet paper more than anything else, but occasionally we'd catch some. They always liked to have one just in case, so they could surrender and get a free rest camp for a while. One time I dropped a bunch of leaflets on our own camp just for the hell of it. Psychological warfare, basically saying, good idea to surrender, you've got it miserable and all that.
And that it was then written in Vietnamese.
Right.
And you would, how would you drop these from the
air? From an airplane, just, you know, like throwing them out the window.
And then did most of the people read them? I mean, could they read? How was the literacy?
The literacy was quite high, actually. Just, you know, most of the people we would, you drop them up, weren't really interested. They were serious about the war, more so than we were. But it was a strange operation, because when we were attaining up, we called it Fire Base of the Month Club. We would move in, take an area, which meant generally we had to kill people and lose some ourselves, and then a month later we would leave, which was absolute insanity, but that's the way the plan was.
So you just go from one place to another?
Right. We did that for about 6-8 months, and then we settled in Bearcat.
And what type of living conditions did you have there?
Well, I remember when we built the firebase in Bearcat, I spent a week living in a conics container, which is about an 8-foot square steel shipping container. We used to make what we call dog houses, which is a couple sections of steel covert, half arcs, placed on top of ammo boxes, then sandbagged. So that was when you were living good. Out on the field, you wrap yourself up in a poncho, one over you. Now, when I worked with the Vietnamese, that was decent. You're talking about houses and all, but of course, nothing in the way of what you call sanitary facilities, showers, hot running water, but at least it was in out of the rain.
Mm-hmm. What type of dwelling was it?
Most of them were, you'd call shacks around here. The higher up the scale, the better the housing. The typical peasant house was really, a wooden or bamboo frame, was thatched with leaves and something like that, a bamboo hut like you see on Gilligan's Island, mm-hmm. all the way up to, stucco and brick mansions like you'd see in the South almost, for ones who got them from the French or, had money.
Did you get to live in any of those?
Occasionally.
Did you?
Occasionally.
Well, what about, what did you eat? I mean, out in the field you ate rations.
Yeah. The typical ration, sea rations, which are, meal in a can. I stuck to things like meatballs and beans and franks, stuff you could eat cold. Later on, we have what they call LERP rations, which were freeze-dried, dehydrated, which basically it looked like dog food and you mix it with water. It wasn't too bad. I ate well when I worked for Vietnamese, lots of rice, which surprisingly I still love. But fresh fruits, vegetables, meat, beef was a delicacy over there. Most of their meat would be like, fish, chicken, occasionally pork. Beef was very, very rare. There's a delicacy, but, Vietnamese cuisine is very similar to Chinese. You see lots of rice, lots of vegetables, a little bit of meat. One of the things the French introduced to Vietnam was baking, so usually you could have some delicious French bread with it. But, I live fairly well. The Vietnamese I were working with would be middle class and upper class. The typical Vietnamese peasant, you'd have rice three times a day, and if you're lucky, a little bit of meat and vegetables for supper. So the typical Vietnamese peasant family, the income back then per capita was about $125 a year. I was responsible for what we called the Kit Carson Scouts, which were Vietnamese who worked for the U.S. Army. A lot of them were former Viet Cong, former NVA soldiers that had seen the light. Some were mercenaries, and we paid them the equivalent of about $25 a month or so.
Really?
Yeah, plus benefits and all. So for the privilege of being allowed to shoot their countrymen, they could live two or three times as well as the typical farmer. Very much, and it was ridiculous when you saw our standard of living contrasted to theirs. Like I said, $125 a year is the typical income. We'd have GIs blowing that much on wine, women, and song, wondering what are these people upset about? So it was a very poor country, but very nice people. Most of them, all they really wanted to do was just be left alone. They didn't care who was in charge, just leave us alone, let us, raise our family, raise our farm, and everything else. So I was lucky that I worked with the real Vietnamese, not the ones that were in the cities and so on like that.
Now, were you close to any major cities, or was it basically
Binh Hoa was, quote, a major city.
Mm-hmm.
What they consider a city is not what we would consider a city, but it had the typical... It would have, the restaurants, the stores, the markets, the hospitals, and so on like that. It'd be, their city would be what we consider a very small town. Something like, say, Girard or Niles would be a big city there. Saigon was something in turn. That was a major city by any standards.
And more westernized.
Very westernized, the French influence was very prevalent there. But you'd have... contrast even there, in the center of the city, you'd be looking at hotels that were 10-15 floors of marble and glass. Walk a few streets down, you're in the slums where they got, you know, open garbage pits and sewers and everything else. So another contrast, you know, a lot of wealth, a lot of poverty.
Did you enjoy your time there?
Most of it, honestly, yes. I enjoyed working with the Vietnamese. You know, most of the people I worked with, a lot of them had come out of North Vietnam in the 50s after the first war. And this is home now, and they were determined not to be pushed anymore. And so most of them were, they were ready to die in place rather than retreat again. And they were fighting for their homes. They were serious about it. Vietnam, the country itself, until late in the war years, didn't have a draft or anything. A typical, like the American draft, if you had a wealthy family connections, you could avoid the draft. And so generally, the Vietnamese who did the fighting were, for the most part, like the Americans did the fighting, lower class, maybe middle class, very few upper class. But the Vietnamese had been fighting for centuries. The last wars that most people think of, they fought the Japanese in World War II, then the French after that, and then, you know, either they were fighting Americans or fighting North Vietnamese from about 55 on. I've worked with people who have been fighting literally almost all their whole lives. I've worked with people who have been fighting for 20, 30 years. For sheer survival. I mean, that's all, they were just living day to day, surviving, hoping things would be better for their children. Because regardless of how Vietnam came out, you know, we bought them time. We probably gave them at least another 10 years the way things would have been without us. So we gave them an extra 10 years. You know, then we abandoned them. I was a student of the war and still am to some extent, but everything I've ever seen and read and talked to indicates that, for the most part, the initial phases of the war in Vietnam that we were involved in was almost a civil war where, you know, it was the Viet Cong against the Vietnamese government, and it was only after about 64 or so when the U.S. started adding troops that the North Vietnamese started coming in. So basically, it was almost like a poker game. We raise, we see the ante, we raise, then you know, back and forth, and you got almost stupid with national pride. But after the 1968 Tet Operation, 68-69, the Viet Cong had almost been wiped out of existence, and it became mainly a North Vietnamese operation. The troops we fought against most of the time in our operation was the 274th Viet Cong Regiment. However, it was later designated as North Vietnamese. Most of it were North Vietnamese troops that had come down and joined, but, you know, supposedly this was still a civil war, just like we were just there to help the Vietnamese. But there's always been controversy about the effectiveness of the Vietnamese fighting men and women. I remember one woman, she'd lost her family, and all she lived for was revenge. And when I met her, she was probably early 30s and had killed at least 50 Viet Cong or NVA herself and wanted more. The people I worked with were motivated. They were fighting for their homes. Other units, the ones I worked with were serious. The regional forces, provisional forces. The other people I worked with were what the provincial reconnaissance units, which were a outgrowth of some of the special forces and CIA operatives. They were extremely dangerous people.
Were they?
Yes, they were very hardcore. I was fortunate the Vietnamese I worked with were good. I've heard comments on how most of the Vietnamese troops weren't worth a damn. I don't know from personal experience about that. All I can think is, you know, after you've been fighting for 10, 15, 20 years, you're a little tired of listening to some guy that's coming in for a year or so telling you how to fight a war. One of my Vietnamese NCOs had been a officer in the North Vietnamese Army, and he'd been fighting the French first. He'd been fighting for over 20 years himself, and he was still in his 30s, ever since he was a teenager. Lots of people I worked with, that's all their families can remember, war. The biggest single thing I can remember really was the Easter Offensive of 1972, which never got that much publicity, really, but it was almost a reverse of the Tet 68 offensive. That was a surprise, and we had the Easter Offensive of 1972. We knew it was coming. We captured people. We had tons of. It was basically a massacre for the North Vietnamese, and the Arvins fought well. So it was, that's the biggest thing I remember, shooting holes in tanks and things like that. But the whole tour, I was lucky. I saw some combat, but not as much of the usual line troops. I was lucky in that I was able to work with Vietnamese, and I saw a lot more of their country rather than. Typical American saw very, very little of the country, except for, maybe the bars and the whorehouses, and, most of them didn't speak the language. And then, it'd be like saying, Las Vegas is typical America. And so I got a lot better feel for the country than most Americans did, and I feel lucky in that way.
How did you travel throughout the country?
Most of the time by Jeep and helicopter.
Mm-hmm. And you would take a trip like on a daily basis or weekly?
Yeah, well, I had my own Jeep assigned to me when I was doing liaison, and then towards the end of my tour, I was doing courier duty also, and I had a section of four gun Jeeps plus other transport. So then a lot of times we went from one place to another. Most of the time, traveled by Jeep more than anything else.
Weren't afraid of landmines or ambushes?
No. Honestly, figured when my time was up, it was up. Because, regardless, we were there when the war was supposed to be winding down, but if I remember correctly, in my battalion, we had like 21 officers, and I think about 14 of them got wounded.
Mm-hmm.
So it was still dangerous there. We lost more people to accidents and disease than anything else. Nope. Very much.
When you were there, you probably carried images of home and your former civilian life with you. What were those images?
Biggest thing I remember is the holidays, especially Christmas. The Vietnamese are like any other country, they're very much into family, home and family. And holidays. Their Tet is the major holiday. It's Lunar New Year, and that's pretty much Christmas, New Year's, and everything rolled into one for them. But they have other holidays also. For us, all the holidays are what you remembered, because that's what you remembered about home more than anything else. Always them, Thanksgiving, they're hauling containers of turkey and cranberry sauce and mashed potatoes and gravy out to troops in the field. Christmas, guys are setting up Christmas trees and bunkers and everything. New Year's, they're firing flares off, things like that. 4th of July, we got celebrated. First night I was in Vietnam, I heard what I thought was thunder. It turned out to be enemy mortar fire celebrating the 4th of July for us. But you tend to remember the holidays, because you figured by celebrating them there and your family and friends are celebrating home, there's some, bridge there. Those are the things you remember more than anything else. remember things like in-country R&R, rest and relaxation. They had a French beach resort, Cap Saint-Jacques, under French was Bong Tao. And one side of the beach was used by Americans, one side by the bad guys. And we would wave to each other. We ignored each other. Okay, I'll shoot you tomorrow, but damn, relaxing.
Really?
Oh, yeah. It was strange. And then again, there was always the French. Lovely bunch of people, I always thought. Michelin rubber. One reason I will never own Michelin tires, they owned huge rubber plantations, and they paid bribes and taxes to both sides to be let alone, and so in our area, the rubber plantations were usually sanctuaries for the bad guys, and we weren't allowed to go in there. So it was a strange war. See everything going on, the one you'd see. One day you'd be seeing New York fashion show or Sammy Davis Jr. or Bob Hope, that type of thing, and then a couple of days later you'd be walking through what had been left of a village or something like that.
Yeah. That much of a difference.
It's a schizoid. Change the weather. Most of it was, you got used to it as much as you could after a while, but the weather generally hot and humid, oppressive. The monsoons, you'd have a week or two of, freezing rains. You couldn't get warm, you couldn't get dry, things like that. You'd be living in a little sandbag hovel, and then you'd go down the street and you'd see these absolutely beautiful temples and pagodas, and you'd see the artwork. You'd just such utter contrast. Or you'd fly over these absolutely beautiful landscapes. Vietnam is very much like the U.S. Most of the area we worked in, I would say the landscape was more like Mill Creek Park than a jungle. It was forest, not heavily forest either, but some areas were heavily, jungle work. You don't know if it was day or light. You couldn't see. Others were just forest. Most of the areas we worked in were what you'd call forest rather than a jungle, almost like a typical park.
You could maneuver through
them. Beautiful area, you'd fly over and you'd notice the outlines, where, say, French forts have been overgrown and so on like that. Just amazing, but beautiful country. Just the scenery, the flowers, the trees, the animals, all the old buildings, the temples and so on. Nice people, friendly, if you tried to know them and go by their rules. But for the most part, we didn't. Undoubtedly, American syndrome was alive and well in Vietnam. God, was it alive and well. I know back in the late 60s, early 70s, the Army, to some extent, reflected problems like race and drugs, but we were probably better off than most of the country at the time because there are only two colors in Vietnam, green and red, green uniforms and red blood. So I honestly didn't see much in the way of racial conflict. I saw a lot more conflict between the guys who would drink and the guys who used like marijuana, and it was them against everyone who used the hard drugs. It was strange.
Is there a lot of structure with your
most of us looked like a bunch of bandits.
So it was pretty relaxed.
I was a little bit different because, since I had a regular assignment, I was able to wore normal type uniform. In the field, because resupply, generally, most of the missions lasted about 2 or 3 days. Sometimes they resupplied. It just didn't matter. You would dump bags of uniforms in laundry, so, no one ever had a uniform that was his own. I was, in the rear, I was able to have most of my own, we had regulation about on the field, it was, you know, be as comfortable as possible. So it looked like a bunch of bandits for the most part.
The images that you brought up home, you know, the holidays and that,
yeah.
Were there other ones that you thought of along the way that you zeroed in more? Anything that you thought maybe wouldn't change and when you got home did change?
Hard to say. A lot of it changed somewhat beforehand because of the training I went through. I thought I knew what to expect in Vietnam, but it was a lot worse than I had expected and been trained for. So kind of after I was a lot more cautious, a lot more paranoid, a lot harder to get along with. It's, you know, a lot more calloused. Because our basic job was to kill people. That's what we did. That's what we were trained for, that's what we did, and unfortunately we did it very well. The Vietnam Memorial commemorates 50, 60,000 men and women who died for the U.S. South Vietnamese lost about 250,000, North Vietnam as many as a million. People don't really get the cost, but, you know, especially, you know, you try not to remember, but you don't forget the people you killed, and try to remember that you actually wiped out, we wiped out our generation there. The average age of the American soldier and the Vietnamese soldier on both sides is about 19.
They were
young. They're always going to be 19.
But that was the North Vietnamese soldier, the professional soldier.
The typical North Vietnamese professional soldier was like ours. He was a 19-year-old draftee that said, congratulations, you're going to, you know, South Vietnam.
Which was entirely different from the children and the guerrillas or the goons,
right,
as they called them.
Yeah.
He was a professional,
yeah,
soldier like we were.
Yeah, and they were, most of the ones we played with were as good as our own. The 1st Air Cavalry Division was probably the best line unit in Vietnam. And most of the North Vietnamese we fought with, I thought were our equals, at least our equals, in some cases better, because they had more experience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the only reason we overcame most cases, you know, we were able to move faster, we had more firepower and more supplies. It was a strange war, and it didn't come down to the individual soldier so much as national will, and the North Vietnamese had more will to win, which is one of their phrases, you know, will to win. That's what this country didn't have. And that's why we won the war, but gave up. Because there's no way, when you kill a million people compared to 50,000, there's no way you can say you lost. But when you say, okay, we're going home and desert the South Vietnamese like we did. So it's, you know, strange war. It's never really going to be settled because there's thousands of Vietnam veterans who are never going to forget it. We still have a couple thousand MIAs missing in action. The North Vietnamese have 200 or 300 thousand were still missing in action. And most of Buddhist religion, you know, not being given a proper burial, not being brought home, is pretty much dooming them to wander in limbo for eternity. So we did not help that country that much except buying them time. So we gave them an extra 2 years. Probably I'd say it definitely was not as friendly as outgoing, you know, being an act of paranoid. because Vietnam, there was no real front lines. You never knew when something can happen. You know, there's no safe areas. With the work I was doing with the Kit Carson Scouts and the Vietnamese, and plus the tons, I was worth supposedly $2,500 from my head, which is about 20 years' pay for a typical Vietnamese. So.
Yeah, bounty for you, really.
Yeah.
Did you establish friendships there?
Oh,
well,
yeah.
You know,
I keep wondering what happened to a lot of the people I knew. My chief interpreter, we called him Long Bin. One of the major cities was called Long Bin, and his name happened to be Bin. He was very tall for a Vietnamese, I'd say pretty close to 6 feet. But he had fought against the Japanese, then against the French. You know, he spoke about 7 or 8 languages. He spoke better English than most of our troops. But as an indicator, in my battalion, okay, counting myself, there were only 3 or 4 officers who spoke Vietnamese, and there may be a couple of NCOs, so most of the troops that were there had no idea. It was a completely foreign country to them, but they had no idea what was going on. No conception. They looked down on the people. I know one of the things that always amazed me and disappointed me was the amount of bigotry and racism I saw on the part of minority American troops, blacks and Hispanics, who, you know, supposedly the oppressed in the U.S., they would be calling Vietnamese slopes and dinks, cussing them out because they couldn't speak English and mistreating them, things like that.
Well, you thought they would have understood.
Easy. You know, you thought, you know, gee, you know, you should have something in common with them. But I prefer to remember the good thing. I remember the people I knew that were good people. The fact that I was lucky enough to have a job that I could do something in and accomplish something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It does seem like you did that. I mean, our conversation. A vital, vital conversation.
Right. But
you think
the political factors.
I mean, at least you can look back and think.
Yes, and no. It's one of those, I left active duty in 73. And I stayed in the reserves a few years, got out of it because I was going to grad school, working full time. There's just no way I could keep up with everything. So, you know, I think it's about 85 or so, I finally, you know, took a discharge. I was a captain up for major then, and I just, you know, but I thought I had Vietnam behind me for years, just basically, you know, I forget about it, but then I, you know, a lot of started when they put up the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. You know, in 82, it started, you know, every time you turn around, there'd be something that started mind me, and, you know, going back and forth, and, you know, started getting, you know, flashbacks. You know, I think, you know, eventually, you know, was what PTSD, you know, and, you know, thought I was going crazy because I had no idea what was going on, and that's when I got involved with some of the veterans groups, you know, we all had some things. And once you know you're not crazy, you're normal for a Vietnam veteran.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and ever since then, I figured that there's no way I can completely forget it. It's a part of my life, for better or worse. So I try to, you know, I collect Vietnam military, you know, I'm working on some articles, probably eventually a book, you know, buying some trade, I'm in, you know, veterans groups and so on like that. So it just, basically, I have to accept, and the question is, you know, am I going to let Vietnam control me, or am I going to control it? I was lucky, a lot luckier than many of the veterans. I was older. I was 24. I turned 25 in Vietnam, so I was several years older than the average Vietnam veteran. I had a college degree, and I'd had a lot more training, so I was a little better prepared for it. And also, I didn't see as much combat as some of the guys did. And I was able to come back, get a fairly decent job, go on with my life. A lot of guys, you know, it's, you take a 19-year-old kid that's been a squad leader, or platoon sergeant even, you know, he's won a bunch of medals. He's done everything. You know, he's had the most important job in the world, literally life and death. If he makes the wrong decisions, someone dies. If he makes the right decisions, someone dies. And you come back and you tell this kid, well, Gene, maybe I can get you a job at McDonald's for the hamburgers. Kid, they can't fit it. And Vietnam veterans were not treated like the veterans from World War II or Korea. Korea was the closest parallel. World War II, the benefits they had would allow a veteran to go to school and still live. With us, the way the GI Bill worked, if you didn't have a job, you couldn't really afford to go to school and what they paid. I figured out that what I got, I think the most I got was a little over $300 a month. So by the time you got done paying your tuitions and books and everything else, it worked out you were getting like 50 cents an hour. And there's simply no way someone could live on $300 a month. And so an awful lot of veterans who would have liked to use the GI Bill were too busy working, surviving to use it. The typical Vietnam veteran went into a factory job, manufacturing, construction, something like that. They're the ones who been hurt the most because they lost that time they're in the service. And for years, they were looked down on. Drug addicts, maybe killers, fruitcakes, so and so. There's still an awful lot of vets out there that probably have been able to be fitted into society. Then again, most of us have got on with our lives, and Vietnam is just part of the history. Some got scars, some physical, some mental, but it's just basically Vietnam is part of your personal history, just like birthdays, births, deaths, whatever, family, just mostly just a matter of, control. Do you control Vietnam or does it control you? And that's the thing of making peace with yourself and the history.
How did home change and your friends and family change when you came back?
It wasn't so much them as me. I was not the same person.
Did you visualize them one way and you came back and everything was...
They hadn't changed. I had changed. Things like, I still do not like sitting unless my back is to a wall or something like that. At night, I still can't sleep unless my bedroom door is closed. For months, I couldn't, unless it was locked, but I had a loaded weapon close by because most of the work I did in combat, both of our set, we worked at night. Night was when we came out to play. So you remember things like that. Loud noise, for God, probably a year after I got back, I either had a gun on me or within a few inches because there are people out there trying to kill me. I brought it home. It's difficult to break habits like that. You jump at loud noises, I hit the ground, acclimatized, but some things stick with you. It's traumatic. Just the way if you've ever been in an auto accident, you avoid going near the place you got hurt. Some things you just basically, it's a permanent imprint and it's a permanent history. So, home didn't change so much for me because, like I said, I was a quote an officer and a gentleman, college graduate. Then again, several months after I came home to Youngstown, the best job I could find was back in Republic Steel as a laborer. So I experienced some of it, who wants to hire a Vietnam veteran?
And you had all this education.
Oh, yeah.
You served your time. You were at a good age, and this is what you could get.
So it's strange. I lost a lot of respect for the country and the government the way they treated Vietnam veterans, and my own opinion is that most of the advances for Vietnam veterans over the past couple decades are because of the vets, not anyone else. Vietnam vets took care of Vietnam vets. It's only now that there's any recognition or acknowledgement. A lot of us are abused by publicity and the uproars, the parades given to people from Desert Storm who did their bit, and then Panama and Grenada. They're wars, but they were they're really a weekend in Vietnam. What a typical combat troop would have had, you know, compared to those. I mean, you know, but that's past. I mean, you know, you can't forget Vietnam, but you can't dwell there. Some veterans have totally withdrawn from society, you know, the stereotype. Most of us are probably about as well adjusted as anyone. Just, you know, we've got a peculiar bit of history and we do a few weird things. You'd be amazed at, I think probably half of all the Tabasco sauce in the country sold to Vietnam veterans. We used it so much in our meals, it was, you know, make it taste a little bit better. Stuff like
over
that.
Today.
Oh, yeah.
So how did you adapt to most of the changes that you saw? What methods did you use?
Just day by day. Yeah. I was, like I said, I was fortunate that, you know, had a family to go back to.
Did you go home? And did you live at home with your folks when you came back?
Not as, see, I took about a 30-day leave, and I was still on active duty, so I was home for a while, unwound, probably drove my folks crazy with my language, and, you know, trying to get used to everything. Mm-hmm. Then, you know, I went back on active duty for about another year and a half, so.
Where did you go after Vietnam?
After I came back from Vietnam, I went down to Fort Hood, Texas. And spent most of my time there as a staff officer also.
What did you do down there?
I was just about assistant everything because I was a very senior first lieutenant. My group, it used to be, one of the problems Vietnam officers promoted extremely fast. When I was in training, we had a 24-year-old major. We had captains that weren't old enough to vote. We had lots of, you know, 20-year-old captains, and back then, you know, you couldn't vote until you were 21.
Mm-hmm.
But used to be you'd go from second lieutenant to first lieutenant in a year, first lieutenant to captain another year after that.
Mm-hmm.
They stopped that with the group just before mine. So in other words, if I had started active duty about 2 weeks earlier, I would have been a captain when I left instead of first lieutenant. So Mike, we were the senior first lieutenants of the Army, and having been a combat veteran on, you know, I generally worked in a slot that a captain would have held.
Mm-hmm.
So I, you know, started out as a supply officer, and they got one of those, and I became the battalion legal officer and an assistant adjutant, which is basically, you know, I handled most of the administration for our battalion.
You had men under you?
Yeah, I had anywhere from 2 to about 50, depending on which assignment I had. When I started at Fort Benning, I had a 500-man instructor company. So I've handled everything from, you know, low of 2 to about 500.
How did Texas compare to Vietnam? I mean, was it a climate-wise?
It was dry. Mm-hmm. Texas was really, because, you know, where we were was Fort Hood.
Mm-hmm.
Later than from the shooting history, but there it was warm, but it was dry. Very little humidity. It was nice, comfortable.
Did it seem a culture shock to come back for the, with the people and the areas? And their views were different?
Some. I know the thing that surprised me the most was getting... a few times. But I was down there, and you know, I went past, he said, I was a senior first lieutenant, I went past, I think it was a colonel, said, good morning, he said, you must be just back from Vietnam. I said, huh? You didn't salute. If you did not salute in a war zone, it's a good way to point someone out to a sniper or something. So I had to get used to saluting, and I had to get used to being saluted. It was, you know, huh? Oh, yeah. One of those types of deals was a cultural shock.
Back to military structure.
Yeah. You know, when it's not, you know, well, Lucian, you know, had to worry about, you know, he said being an officer was not quite as adjustment as, you know, would have been someone else, but a lot of the guys I had, you know, they had trouble adjusting from a combat environment to a garrison environment, you know, where there's a lot of BS and, you know, concentrating, you know, spit shine boots and starch fatigues. The Vietnam was, you know, can you do the job? Over here, you know, gee, you need a haircut or gee, you don't have this straight, that type of thing, you know. So it was adjustment, you know, just basically like adult moving back in with his parents and having to live under the same rules when he was a kid. You know, big adjustment for, you know, the troops. Me, it wasn't so bad because we were the ones who were making the rules, so. But, you know, one of the biggest adjustments was women.
Really?
Because, you know, in a combat zone, about the only ones you saw were occasionally were the donut dollies, the American Red Cross volunteers, and that's what most of the American Union, you know, just, you know, some, you know, most, you know, gee, you know, not everyone has black hair. Something like that, you know, just, you know. And Vietnamese are little people, it's, you know, shocked talk to a woman who is as tall as you are, or something like that, just, you know. And the fashions and everything, because over there, everyone dressed fatigued and so on, and the Vietnamese dressed, and you're just, you know, getting used to, you know, seeing all the vehicles, too. That was the biggest adjustment, because over there, most people are poor, so, you know, maybe they've got a bicycle or they walk. A status symbol was a moped or a scooter. A car was, you know, what the very wealthy had. Most people, you know, you'd see a bus with a couple hundred people hanging on it almost. I mean, that was, you know, just the traffic, all the noise and all the pollution. And, you know, being able to, you know, I spent a week in Australian R&R, and I think I spent the first half hour turning on the air conditioning, flushing the toilet, and washing the shower. You know, just, you know, things that you, you know, civilization is things like electricity and running water, hot showers that you just take for granted, and, you know, those are things, you know, get amazed by.
Because you didn't have any of that when you
were. No.
Did you have any electricity?
Yeah, from generators and so on like that, but most of the Vietnamese I worked, you know, basically it was like the old, you know, sunrise to sunset. I mean, you know, and, you know, they'd have, you know, maybe candles or a smoky oil lamp, and, you know, that was about it. You know, during the day, you know, some night, you know, we eat and you go to bed. Get up, you know, you worked, you know, by sunlight. You know, the major cities, yeah, they had electricity and everything, so there was nightlife and, you know, shopping. So that most of the people worked pretty much like American farmers did a couple of centuries ago. They, instead of tractors, they had water buffalo. You know, the very poor, no. I mean, you know, they'd, you know, the black pajama bit, that, you know, they're just, you know, like we'd have blue jeans, that's their typical day-to-day clothing. You know, it's simple and it's cheap and it wore well, so they wore it all the day. And, you know, then for festivals and all, they bring out their good stuff. Blue jeans were, you know, status symbol over there, and, you know. It's funny how you remember some things. I remember one of the ultimate status symbols of Vietnam were menthol cigarettes like Salem's and so on. Big status symbol. You know,
did you smoke over there?
Yes and no. I'm a pipe smoker. But, you know, the French, you know, I always carried cigarettes and matches and all because that, you know, you'd have cigarettes together and so on like that. So always carried cigarettes. You know, I was lucky that when I was been, I had training in language because from a Vietnamese officer, I knew here in the U.S., people think one thing if they see a couple of guys walking down the street holding hands. In Vietnam, that's what friends do. So, I mean, when I got to where I could accept that and not, you know, the first time one of my counterparts, you know, started holding my hand, I didn't, you know, start screaming. When you, I knew what it was about. I was lucky because I knew the culture and the people.
You
most
didn't just
Americans
learn the
didn't.
Language, you learn the culture
yeah.
and the people.
Yeah.
That's
the biggest thing I remember about the language, you know, I'm fluent, but I'm probably damn near tone deaf. The Vietnamese is a very tonal language. A word will have several meanings just the way you pronounce it. Okay, God, I'm probably screwing the pronunciation up after 20 years, but word ma, M-A, can mean mother, ghost, and tiger. How you, depending on how you pronounce it, but just
is
by
the
tones, it's just almost bad as French and all that. But I know I used to talk about meeting some, they'd be rolling on the ground laughing, and I said, "Okay, guys, tell me what I said. I knew what I wanted, but
what you wanted and what you
yeah,
said were
but,
two different things."
If you're very friendly people as long as you'd meet them halfway. If you treated them decently, you know, fantastic people. I loved them. But I mean, thinking, it's hard for us to imagine, something where a status symbol is having a pack of Sam cigarettes. Or a Timex watch, something, or things like that. Or, a steel pot. Like a little motor scooter or a motorized bike. Status symbol. I mean, things, we take for granted are, incredible. And, still, after 20 years, things, a pack of cigarettes was a status symbol. Things like that. And because they were, sometimes almost a feudal society, there was, very class-conscious, very status-conscious, very much more so than we are. A lot of it, tied back into the French, where the only ones who got ahead under the French were those who went for the French. So if you supported the French, you could go on for schooling. You'd get the good jobs. If you didn't or didn't have connections, you stayed a peasant or you became a Viet Cong. But when you think of things, 20 years ago, were things you take for, like an electric fan. That was a luxury. Or a car. Car, incredible. Major transportation, I remember buses, you would have buses, they would have crates of chickens, they'd have pigs, they'd have baskets of fruits and vegetables on top, and people would be, crammed into the seats, they'd be standing in the aisle, they'd be hanging on the bus. That's the major transportation, because otherwise you walked. People walked. People had a hard life there. I'm going to be 45 in a couple of weeks, and someone 45 looks like they're about one step for the week. They had a very hard life. But they didn't complain. They just wanted to be left alone so they could live their life. I contrast what I saw with, Saigon. We were there for training 6 months after we'd been doing the job.
They sent you for training.
Right. But we ate, I can't remember which restaurant it was, but it's either the Caravelle or the Majestic. But this was built during the French era, and all marble. Had a restaurant on the top floor, and all glass, and you could see the stars. It was marble and pillars and so on. We had about a 7-course meal, Chateaubriand, wine, cheese, and everything, about $5 a piece. Mm-hmm. If you had, we had French cooking too, Waiters spent French and everything, there was such a difference in class, lot more noticeable than you notice here. But like I said, a couple blocks, you got slums, a couple more, you've got, champagne and caviar type. Incredible. But give you an idea of the, when I came in 1971, the Vietnamese money was worth about 270 of their dollars equaled one of ours. When I left, it was over 400 to one of ours. So it was practically monopoly money. Mm-hmm. But it was fun playing poker, and, I'll see your 5,000, I'll raise you 10,000. But, in a country, one of the things, the Americans did that did not help, typical American GI, probably saved most of the money set at home, but, he'd go on Arnold's, he'd have, $50, $100, which is like a year's pay for these people, and, think nothing of it. And just, the contrast, we gave them good lessons in how to hate Americans. The ugly American was, ones that you treated, great people, but, like any other culture, we made probably more mistakes than we did things right there.
It's got to be hard thinking about that.
I've always wondered what my people would have been on death list because what we were involved in, a lot of the operations we worked on were, you know, the CIA Phoenix type operation. We were serious about, you know, we got involved, you know, it was quite serious. But then, you know, the scouts I had were, most of them were former Viet Cong or NVA, and, you know, some, you know, probably very few of them survived. I mean, lucky ones might have got out with their families and all in about 75 or so, but most of the Vietnamese that escaped first weren't the ones closest to the Americans. It was the ones who had the political connections, the money. The ones who did most of the fighting, you know, like, talk to people, especially when you're the Mount Yards, which are Vietnamese hillbillies, is the closest thing to them, you know, we deserted them wholesale. But for the most part, we deserted the Vietnamese. We said, you know, gee, you know, something we want to forget, so we forgot them.
Anything that you'd like to add that I didn't cover or that you thought maybe I would
add? Like I said, most Vietnam veterans have adjusted. Generally, though, the younger they were, the more combat they saw made it harder for them just so, you know, it depends. Like the Marines generally had a worse war. But the younger guy, the guy was, you know, 18, 19, he come out of high school or maybe even dropped out, and, you know, year after that he's killing people. And a couple days after he's doing that, he's on a plane, come home, and, you know, gee, sonny, how you doing? You know, just, you know, such another, there's no transition. You know, that was the thing that they had coming home on troops, is when you could have a chance to depressurize or come off of it, to adjust. But I know even when I came, you know, I landed, Fort Dix, and that was it. You know, just nothing on, you know, what to expect, or just, you know, literally, see ya.
You're here, and
that's
don't
it.
Do
like
what we're going to have you do next.
You know, 2 days before I was home, I was getting shot at. Just, you know, total, you know, there's just no way to, no readjustment period or anything, just, you know, boom, boom. Very strange.